Accession number 8736, rule number 6.
Lord Harding, tape 6. Could I ask you now about your experience in the Suez Canal zone, Lord Harding? Whereabouts were you sent?
At the southern end of the canal. We were in camp on the west bank. No, it must have been on the east. Yes, on the west bank, that's right. At a place called Kubri, K-U-B-R-I, I think it is. It was, about 10 or 15 miles north of Suez. And we were encamped there, and the division was holding that front, and they had infantry posts out about... I suppose up to 10 or 15 miles. I can't remember which way is the country.
East, yes.
Towards Sinai. East of the canal. Infantry post. And then they formed a brigade machine gun company. They had started forming brigade machine gun companies. On the Western Front some months before, I don't precisely know when, but then it was decided to do the same. It was in the Egyptian Expeditionary Forces, it was called in those days, and I was told that I was to take command of the 162 Brigade Machine Gun Company and form it. And it was formed by taking the machine gun sections from each of the four battalions in the brigade. I already knew them and the officers commanding them, but they were pretty well picked men, the machine gun sections of the four infantry battalions, and we put them together in a machine gun company and as an independent unit with its own headquarters and administration, and I was put in command of that. And we had most of our guns at that sections at that time were deployed with the infantry posts east of the canal on the front line there, and the whole purpose of that was, of course, to defend the canal against any possible large-scale Turkish attack, and they had. There had been previously, I think, a Turkish thrust towards the canal further north, above Ismailia. And so it was thought that the Turks might launch a full-scale offensive against the canal. And that was the whole purpose, raison d'etre for the defensive position. And they used to patrol out towards the hills, the mountains. And they had a swept track along parallel with the canal and about a mile or so east of it. It was the sand was swept clean every evening, and then it was inspected every morning. And somebody had to ride along each section of the track every morning to see whether there are any footprints or wheel marks or hoof marks across the track, so as to make sure that if any small raiding party came down to put mines in the canal, it was immediately spotted. And one of my jobs, in turn with other people, was to ride along this swept track and see whether there are any footprints or marks, any movement, any sign of being crossed. I never found anything at all, so it was never crossed in our area. my camp was on the banks of the canal, just close to with, there was a squadron of the Hearts of Germany, I think, and some guns and gunners and so on there. And I remember I had a little hut actually bang on the bank of the canal. And we used to, my chaps used to, whenever a ship went down the canal, we used to form up and sort of wave to them, see, and the passengers used to throw out things for us, odds and ends and things like that, food or a deck chair possibly would be thrown out, and we would pick it up. We used to bathe, swim in the canal. And we were there, and we used to go out into, and I used to go around and visit the infantry posts and my sections that were with them, and they were defended, properly dug in posts with wire and that sort of thing. But they were never attacked. And, we remained there until the advance into Palestine began. And then the division was moved up to Kantara, which is on the east, still on the east bank, but in the north of Ismailia. And we started off as a follow-up division for the advance across Sinai. Actually, we marched right on until, what's the name of the place? Before you get to Gaza on the coast, and there we didn't do any fighting in the Sinai Desert at all. We've just followed up.
Before I ask you about that, could I just check up on your rank at this time?
Well, I think I'd been made a temporary major.
A temporary major?
I think so. In command of the Brigade Machine Gun Company.
But you were very young to be a temporary major,
well,
were you not?
About 20, I suppose. By then, yes. Well, I suppose I was, yes.
Were you, was this idea of forming the machine gun companies, was that good, do you think?
Well, it was good, yes, it was. You see, it meant that the machine guns of the brigade were much more flexible. I mean, instead of each battalion having its own Vickers machine guns, you had them grouped in a brigade company, and so you could put... You could deploy the whole of the company in support of the forward troops, instead of their just having their own four guns. So you could deploy 16 guns on the brigade front or in support of the brigade in whatever distribution was necessary to meet the need to deal with what the job was. Yes, it was. It made it more flexible, more mobile, and more adaptable, and I think it helped over training, because the training of the machine gunners was centralized in a company, in one company, instead of being within a battalion, or each section being within its own battalion. And it didn't, I don't think it had any adverse effect on the morale or feeling, the sort of feeling of leaving their battalions, because they were working with their battalions. See, the same battalions, there were the two London battalions, the 10th and the 11th, and the Bedfords and the Northamptons. And the sections were, they came from those battalions, and they used, I mean, if other things being equal, you'd use the section from the battalion to support that battalion. But you could. You could put the two sections in support, or in support of one of the battalions, or you could put the whole four. And in defence, you could deploy them as best suited to the brigade front, rather than the confined just to the one battalion front.
So
no, I think it was a good arrangement.
And that would have been your job, I presume, planning where they were going
planning
to be deployed.
How to make the best use of them, first of all, in that situation, in a defensive position on the east of the canal, and then, as time went later on in the offensive, I think I explained later at the Third Battle of Gaza, I used the whole battalion, which I was then in command of, in support of the main attack.
Yes, I must ask you about that when we come to the third battle. But I suppose it must have been satisfying for you to be able to do your own planning.
Well, it was very good for me, you see, because instead of I'd grown up, so to speak, from a purely battalion outlook to a brigade outlook, and I thought in terms of a brigade operation rather than just of a battalion operation. So that, so I was starting to grow up, if I may put it that way, rather proudly.
And you were still a territorial, were you?
Oh yes,
your I was status still, at
no,
this time.
No, wait a minute. Yes, yes, I was, I think. Sometime, I think, well, it must have been when we were still at Anzac, a circular came round asking for, inviting people, territorials, to apply for regular commissions. And by that time, I was a captain, and I had quite a lot of responsibility. And the life, the army life, was much more attractive to me, even in on active service, than going back to London and working in an office. And so I decided to apply for a regular commission. And I applied for a regular commission in my county regiment, the Somerset Light Infantry, because, as I told you earlier, we are a strong, very partisan Somerset family. And much to my delight, and somewhat to my surprise, I was given, I think it was in early 17, I was granted a regular commission as a lieutenant, as a two-star job in the Somerset Light Infantry. But I remained in the Machine Gun Corps. I remained seconded to the Machine Gun Corps.
With the rank of Acting Major?
With the rank, I think, of Acting Major, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. You know, it's good to fill in your sort of rise, I think, as we go along. But could I now take up your move into Palestine? When you went forward, how easy was it to get your stuff? You know, what was the transport situation then?
Well, they were building a railway then. And I don't think, well, we had two types of transport, really. Within the company, within the machine gun company, we had mules for the guns and the ammunition, and we had camels for baggage and so on. I don't know how many of each, but it was a mixture of mules and camels. And the thing about them was the mules were Argentine mules, and they hated the smell of camels. So. Well, like so much people do. And when you bivouacked for the night, you had to make sure that the mules were downwind of the camels. Otherwise, you were certain to have a stampede during the night. So that was a complication. No, we marched across Sinai, along the coastal side.
Did you have this sort of netting road?
No, we didn't. No, I don't know whether it was there, but we weren't allowed to use it. It's pretty heavy going in that part of Sinai. The coastal region is better than further inland, but it's heavy sand and sand dunes, and it's not easy marching. But it was all right. I mean, we had no motor transport, of course, at all. So with our mules and camels, I don't know what sort of distance we covered. I don't remember. I think we probably covered 10 to 15 miles a day.
Would you have been on foot, Lord Harding? Would you have marched alongside?
No, I had a horse. The company commander and the section commanders were mounted on horses. And so I was all right. I had a horse. So I did march sometimes to be with my chaps. By and large, no, I had a very good pony. It was a small horse. And I started riding when I was with the battalion at home before we went out. And I got very keen on riding, that sort of thing. And so I was pleased. I always said one of the reasons why, or perhaps the main reason why I applied for a regular commission was to have a horse to ride. So I don't know how many days march it was. We had more water than we had had in Gallipoli, but not an awful lot. And then we arrived and we camped, and I can't for the life of me remember the place, somewhere south of Gaza. Yes, my brigade was on the right flank of the attack. And the Turkish defensive position, as far as I remember it, was on the rising ground on the south side of Gaza, running along highish ground to the east. And the brigade was to attack on the right flank of the offensive across some very open plain running up to the Turkish position. A longish advance it was, and there was barley. There were barley growing about knee height on the field, which of course made it difficult because as soon as the advancing infantry lay down to fire or to return the fire or to get their breath, for example, they were completely out of sight. They were out of sight of the enemy, but they were also unable to develop any firepower. It was a good many hundred yards across this open space with growing barley. And my guns, I had, I think, a section with each of the, I think the attack was done on a two battalion front. I had a section with each of the forward battalions, and then the two remaining sections in reserve on the lower ridge. It was a light, small escarpment that we were on. I should think about 1,000, 1,500 yards, maybe more, from the Turkish forward line. And the infantry started to advance, and the Turkish fire was pretty heavy, and I was on the escarpment, and then the Turkish shell fire came round, and I think it was the rifle bullet I got through my arm, not through my leg. It missed my elbow, fortunately, but it put me out of action. And I was evacuated and went back into hospital in Alexandria this time. A very attractive, what had been a hospital, I think, before, Razel Tin, near the harbour in Alexandria. And I don't know how long I was there, but I did. I wasn't very long in hospital. And I recovered all right, and then I went back and resumed command of my company. And at that between the time that I was wounded and the time I got back, the Second Battle of Gaza, which was again a failure, took place. And I got back in time they decided then to call a halt. Allenby had taken over from Murray. De Bell had been replaced, I think, by Chetwood as the corps commander, as the commander there, and we were ecstatic, preparing for a major offensive.
Before I ask you about that planning, because we're very interested in that, you know, the amount of planning that was done for the Third Battle of Gaza, could I ask you a little more about the First Battle? What degree of planning was done for that? Was it as well planned as, say, the Third Battle?
No, it wasn't planned. As far as I know, it wasn't planned in anything like the same detail. I don't know what the plans were for artillery support of the attack. No, it wasn't. It was the brigade was launched into the attack. in open order, I think on the 2 battalion front, across this open area with barley growing in it. And the objective was quite clear, because the Gaza hills the Gaza was built on is where the Turks were, and you knew you could see really where the Turkish positions were, and the whole object of that operation was to outflank the Turkish defences of Gaza and turn their position with a right flanking movement.
Was it a realistic strategy, do you think, bearing in mind?
Well, I don't think it was, looking back on it and with hindsight, I don't think it was realistic to launch infantry across that open space with barley, knee deep in barley, without a more effective and carefully planned artillery support.
Was that a weakness, do you think, the lack of artillery at that first battle?
I don't know. I don't know if it's decisive. I say in those days you had you have a regiment, a field artillery, so had 18 pounders. And those are the only guns. I don't remember any heavier artillery being in use, but there probably was. But as far as I know, there was the 18 pounders were in support of that. And by observed fire, I don't think there was the concept of a large scale or intensity barrage had reached the Mediterranean by that time. So it was observed fire and by individual batteries in support of the advancing infantry. I would have doubted whether there was any really carefully planned and carried out counter-bombardment, counter-battery work. And certainly there was no, I don't remember any air reconnaissance or anything like that, but there may have been.
How did you cope for things like supplies of ammunition and water at that battle?
Well, it's all done by mule transport.
And did they cope with that? Was that coped with? Were the men supplied?
I don't remember in that battle. We certainly didn't run short of ammunition. We didn't run short of ammunition. I don't know about the infantry; they might have. But you carried each infantryman carried 150 rounds or something like that, and he had his 2 days or 3 days rations with him.
And water would have been.
And water, he'd just have his water bottle, which will hopefully got refilled each night with water coming up. But the transport, the commissary transport, so to speak, with mule and camel. But there were no. I don't think there were any forward supply depots like we had in the Second World War in the Western Desert. And I don't know the detail of the divisional supply organization worked reasonably well. I don't remember being desperately short of. We got our ration of water, we got our food, our rations of food. We were able to cook on a company basis. And the distribution of food to the forward troops so that they get them a hot meal was difficult.
When you were wounded in your arm, was that taken care of immediately? Was there anyone about who could look after
that? You had a medical orderly in the company. I was at company headquarters, you see, or I was on the ridge, but the company headquarters were just handy. And I had a company sergeant major and a quartermaster sergeant and a couple of clerks, probably, I can't remember. We had telephones then, we had field telephones. And we had a field telephone, not to the sections, not to the forward sections, but to the brigade headquarters. It was one of those things, you wound up like that, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But there were a few telephones. But of course, the line was run along above ground, and you never knew when it could get cut. It could get cut by shell fire. It could get cut by somebody walking over, pulling it out, and that sort of thing. So it wasn't entirely reliable, but it was a help.
So how did you communicate with the sections?
Well, by orderly, by runner. You communicate with forward communication, and then I'm sure we didn't have telephones in the sections. It was by runner.
So if I could go back to your wounding,
yes.
You would have been treated on the spot,
yes,
by your medical
orderly.
Yes,
a field dressing. Yeah. You carried a field dressing, you see. Everybody had a field dressing little packet about the size of a cigarette case. Packet of cigarettes, a bit larger than a packet of cigarettes. And that had lint and bandage in it. So you could dress yourself, provided you could use your... But I was lucky. It went through above my elbow, missed the elbow joint, and came out down to my forearm. So it was just a question of tying it up with a bandage, and then I was evacuated to, well, I don't remember what we had in those days, and eventually I found myself back in Alexandria, in hospital there. There was no question of having an operation or anything like that. It was a clean wound, so it didn't take long to heal.
And the medical facilities were good, were they,
good,
in Alex?
And the hospital was very good. Yes, it was a fully established general hospital in a civilian hospital building, and rather attractive surroundings with a nice garden and that sort of thing. So it was very comfortable.
And were you made a fuss of by the people in Alexandria, the wounded?
Well, yes, people who entertained you and took you to the races and that sort of thing. You went bathing. I don't remember. I don't think it was then. I think it was sometime later when I was on leave. I had a girlfriend, the daughter of one of the Italian consul in Alexandria. Oh, there are people. Yes, people were very kind and hospitable. You got around.